the Aborigines Protection Act. It was used by our government to establish a system that supported the forcible removal of First Nation babies and children in New South Wales over a period of 60 years from 1909 until 1969. In 1942, at the Barenama Mission in northwest New South Wales, Auntie Lorraine Peter was torn from her family at the age of four, along with her five sisters and two brothers. Now, this was to be the start of her life's journey into trauma, abuse, servitude, and ultimately survival and healing. And it has been Lorraine's life calling to help heal others. Among their number, my own wife, Patrice Newell, who was a stolen gen baby. Now, for the last 20 years, Lorraine's been running an organization that helps members of the stolen generation to understand this trauma and find a way to heal. And now the baton is being passed on to Lorraine's brilliant daughter, an educator and facilitator in Sharn, who co-directs the Manumari organization. I welcome you both to our Little Wireless program. It's been 27 years since the Bringing Them Home report was handed down. And in the 16 years since, of course, PM Rudd made an apology to the stolen generations. And I have to ask you, Lorraine, are Indigenous people being listened to in 2024?
They listen, yes, but there is no action to follow that. I thought Kevin Rudd was very brave to do that, but what came out of that apology for me was he apologised to my family, which was really healing for me. That what came out of that was the recommendations, which is not being policed at all. I think the Maramali program does maybe six plus or more now that we've entered the prisons. But, everybody listens to you, but there's no action to follow, you know?
I didn't realise that Aboriginal children nationally are still 10 times as likely to be removed from their families.
Yes. Yes. They've been brought up under the policy like I was. My generation is you're red flagged right through your life, and red flagging means that government keep an eye on your children, my grandchildren, now my greats. So in New South Wales, I need a meeting a week ago, that we're working to have that lifted. Because you live in fear of your children being taken, you know, and you can't shake this fear until you know that they're safe.
Yeah. Lorraine, can you remember much about life on the mission?
No, not on that mission, no. That's in Brewarrina in New South. The only memory I have is being on the back of a truck with my sisters, which were Rachel, Kathy, and my brother Dick, Francis, my sister, Merle, my other sister, Les, my brother, myself, and my younger sister Judy, all taken away on the back of a truck. And all I could see was the gates of the mission that as we were driving out. Anything after that, I must have shut down all my emotions and feelings, because just being separated there was one separation. Then when you were taken, we were separated again into other homes around Sydney, yeah.
Well, let's start at the point where you're taken 650 kilometres to the Cootamundra Domestic Training Home for Aboriginal Girls. Can you tell us about that first experience of loss?
Like I said, your feelings go numb. There's a lot of grief around that loss because it's really hard to describe, Philip, because it's even with inside the home, you're separated from your siblings. They made sure of that. No bonding took place. But, you know, when we arrived, we had all our clothes taken off us. They were burnt, stood there naked in front of them. We were hair shaven. Then we were deloused with chemicals, given a dress to wear and a job, even at four. My sister was two. She was even given a job picking up the pegs. So training started straight away, but you were given a religion and a bed.
So the message was, look white, speak white, act white.
Absolutely.
And you were forbidden to speak your own language.
Oh, yes. Oh, anything to do with culture, it was left at the door as you entered the home. You were forbidden to speak anything about culture, your language, anything to do with it, yeah. Because you were about to learn another's culture, yeah. And forced to forget your own.
And it wasn't just about this abuse of culture. It also involved physical and sexual abuse.
Yes, we had all that. Yeah. In my time, it was the physical, if you forgot to be white, because our mantra every day was speak white, think white and dress white and be white, you know. That was our mantra. That we were brainwashed into thinking. But can I just say there were two things they couldn't take from me was the colour of my skin and my spirit. So with those intact, that's what I hung on to all those years that I was removed from family. And there was one issue I didn't face was the sexual abuse that happened in the home. I knew it happened, but I wasn't ready to face it. I only went back and strong enough to go back and get my four-year-old self out of that dormitory and bring her forward to be with me now. But, you know, that's a lot of trauma around that to actually do that and want to do it.
Well, when you sat on the bed, you describe it as being like a child screaming, then the memories came further back.
Yeah, you know, even today, I can see the figure, I can feel her, I can, and the screaming of the kids as soon as she entered the door, you know.
And is this painful process healing?
It's painful healing, but I tell you what, it's more painful if you don't heal. Yeah.
Tell me, Lorraine, where the girls from Cootamundra were sent to work. I understand that we know of more than 570 Coota girls were sent to work for over 1,200 employers.
That's another very traumatic time of my life when you're sent out to sheep stations as domestics. I mean, that was the end goal of being trained. I think, you know, in 1943, Australia was short on labour, and I think government were training us up to be domestics to fill that gap for white families. And just the trauma of being separated from the girls now and being put out on sheep stations, and all you live in is just this little room. And your job is to be a domestic for these families.
Any money that was paid to domestics for help was paid back, straight back to the government. So effectively, you were slaves to white families.
That's it. When people say there was no slavery in this country, I'm evidence of that, because I think New South Wales were still waiting for wages, yeah.
Would you tell the story about how you had to learn to bake a cake and serve it with appropriate ceremony and deference?
Okay. I often laugh about this one, but our last bit of training was to cook a sponge, which you were taught how to cook, and then you'd ice it, and you'd have the fresh cream inside. Then you would serve the matron in her quarters with her fine china. And because this was like your last teaching before you sent out to work, how to serve high tea. So we would sit there and matron would talk and we'd cut the cake and I'd have a piece, she'd have a piece, and if I passed that test, okay, I was ready to be put out to work.
And you say that you worked for some really nice people, but you were never once invited to sit down with your so-called employers to enjoy a slice of cake and tea.
No, never, never. That's where they drew the line. You were taught how to do it, but you never enjoyed the company, yeah?
Now, Sean, you had a happy childhood growing up with Mum and Dad and your brothers in Darwin. Did you know anything about your Mum's experience as a child?
I think we always knew about the institution, but maybe not the meaning behind that. I think Mum grew up with the ideal that, you know, no one wanted her or no one loved her. So she had a very strong belief in this. So she just kept living the life she thought she was supposed to be living. It wasn't until later when she started her journey that we found this out to be a lie. But growing up, I think I grew up with all the funny stories and all the happy stories from all of my Kuta aunties. And it wasn't, like I said, until later that, you know, the truth started to unravel. And it's strange, but not so strange, that all my friends growing up in Darwin, we found out later when we become adults that we're all Stolen Generations families.
Now, you've always idolised your mum as a child and now, of course, as an adult.
Yes, I think her strength and determination, it never wavers, nor does her fight for justice or wanting that change to happen for our people. You know, her teachings that she's shared with me, also the journey that she shared with myself and my brother, and her love, it also steers me in the right direction and it also provides healing for all of us. You know, her story, it empowers me, but I think it empowers a lot of other people out there in the community as well.
Now, Lorraine, you revisit the girls' home in Cootamundra in the early 1990s. How did that visit come about?
That's about the institution being given back to them, to all the survivors through the government. But going back for the first time, it was horrific for me. I had to walk through all those dormitories and relive that horror through the whole establishment and even go into rooms I'd never even been into. But the grief was massive. And I went away from there, like, I think I cried for a month. Just the grief when I went home to family, and it really...
But you wrote down every feeling.
Oh, yes.
And those writings became the chapters of a book.
Yes. Still unpublished. But I found that, yeah, for 3 years I wrote my feelings and thoughts and what happened, every event. And what emerged from that was stages of healing, which were chapters in the book, but had a tap on the shoulder one day. This is what you need to do with these writings. And I can never, ever print the book out for some reason. I don't know, but it just wouldn't happen. So government were looking for something to help the stolen generation.
Now, the building is now empty, and Kuta Girls Corp was formed in 2013 by survivors and descendants in negotiation with the government to get back and take over, at least as part of reparation for the stolen generation.
Yeah, this is one of our dreams, like... even though it's a house of horror but happy stories as well, we want it back for future generations because it's their legacy that we leave them. It's their story. And right at the moment, government have just secured the safety of these buildings, but it's an ongoing process. So,
but what you want to do is turn them into truth-telling centres.
Truth-telling, and each room that you walk in will be told by different of women of what that room was used for. It's a truth-telling and a museum. That's what we wanted to turn ours into, yeah.
So, Sian, tell me what you see the truth-telling centres achieving.
I think it's for education, so education for the wider community. It's also about healing for descendants and families. So, you know, when we look at the Bringing Them Home inquiry, the national inquiry, that was in the 90s, 1997, 1996, that was the first time stolen generations ever had the opportunity to tell their story. So many of the descendants have missed out on that story being passed down to them. I think it will be a platform for truth-telling and educating the community and for, the younger generation coming through. I think it's important that we change attitudes.
Lorraine, I know this is all very painful, but you went back as a family to Warren in northwestern New South Wales around the same time as Cootamundra. Can you tell me about that trip?
My trip back home to country was the ultimate. In my healing process, two of my mother's sisters were still alive, which gave me a bit of the story. Went out to the old mission, and back in those days, like when I was born in the 30s, 38, one of my cousins said, "Come on, I'll take you, aunt, out to the tree you were born under." And I said, "What? I was born under a tree." He said, "Yeah, we've got all our birthing trees out there on the old mish. We look after them. We fence them off from vandalism or that, or they look after that that piece of land out there, which has become my saviour. Because I had a rebirth right on that land out there where I was born. Under that tree, it was the most amazing experience. And I think hanging on to my spirit is what I was taught later on by cultural mentors, how important that spirit is, yeah.
I feel we should sit in silence for some time while we consider that extraordinary story. How has your mum's journey impacted you, Sian?
I think I was very fortunate in that as Mum undertook her own healing journey, we walked beside her. So at every step of that journey, we were there. So as Mum healed, we healed as a family. I think even though I wasn't taken, Mum's experience still impacts me. So it's that intergenerational trauma that's passed down through the generations. And for me, I think the main thing would be all of the losses. So, you know, as we say, healing is about reconnecting to all of those losses that happened at the time of removal. And I think the same would apply for, you know, my generation and my children's generation and my grandchildren.
Let's now talk about Manumali, I understand that translates to put back together. Lorraine?
Yeah, that's a Gamilaroi word, which I am, and I wanted something, a language from my country to the program to be named after. So, yes, what can I say about it? It's just started out small as a... The government's funded us for the first 6 years once we got it all together, and then now we're self-sufficient, like we just run it without any assistance whatsoever. The demand for this program is massive. I mean, the need for it, you know, we talk about our group of Stolen Generation people, but I see other people, other groups of people that suffer trauma, that come to this country. Everybody suffers trauma. Everybody's got some trauma in their lives, you know, that this is a simple program that we get people to look inside themselves and heal.
Tell me what you pass on in these workshops for outside service providers.
I'll get Sean.
I think it's about working in a culturally safe way. We cover things like the history, the widespread impact it's had on individuals, communities and families. And we share mum's journey in a way that, you know, this is how it might unfold, and we offer potential paths for healing. It also looks at the dangers and the risks associated with healing and things to be aware of, but also, you know, putting in place the right support. So what's going to be helpful for this person or this client that you're working with, and make sure that they're culturally safe supports. And we also encourage for non-Aboriginal workers working in this sector is, you know, always work in partnership with Aboriginal people and particularly the Aboriginal community-controlled sector.
Lorraine, what are the most important priorities for services and supports needed by mobs right now?
I keep saying this, but I get worn down. I think it's the system works for government, but it doesn't work for our mob. You know, it's not structured to help us, because there's no education in the systems. When you get policy writers, they don't know what they don't know. And how can you write a policy? How can you help somebody if you don't know about the trauma associated with the removal? But can I also say that we're talking about one policy here. This trauma started way back on first settlement, yeah? To the communities, taken off lands, to the families, removed emissions, land was taken. We don't want land back. We want access to it. Like I did, I have that go-to place when I want my spirit topped up, you know. But it's the systems do not work. The children in care today is just massive. Is they're just recycling the trauma. Like you take a child and then it goes into white families, it gets the white teachings. That's how it's brought up. But, and I've passed those white teachings on to my two kids, but they have to undo that too. You know, Philip, I screamed when I found there was another identity within me. I didn't know I had this black identity that I had to get to know, and everything that went with my Aboriginal identity. So I was carrying two identities, the black and white, and I was so unbalanced in my healing. Which way do I go? Which way am I pulled?
Well, you're describing very accurately Patrice's experience as well. This, you know, two worlds in total conflict.
Yes, within inside yourself as well. you know, not even in ourselves, but in families in the whole of Australia. Like, and it's the most scariest thing because you have to find your balance between black and white, because we live, work, and breathe both. But and you have to respect both, you know.
Sean, you emphasise intergenerational trauma because it means that the wounds have to be healed or they will just keep going down and down the generations.
That's right. And I think that's a priority that needs to be considered, is that intergenerational healing. This might look different in each community, but I think that's where, you know, it's got to be put back in the hands of the community, because we have the solutions. We do the hard work on the ground. Mm. We support our mob to get better, but it's never taken seriously enough. With the system that Mum was talking about before, you know, it's working exactly how they want it to be working, but it's not going to help our people. There's not enough training out there for people that are working with our people. There's not enough funding to encourage opportunities for families and communities to heal. And it's, you know, this system isn't prioritising family strengthening either. It's just, they just keep taking the kids. I just want them to stop taking our kids. One more is too many.
It's been an honour to talk to you both. My guests have been Auntie Lorraine Peters and Sean Peters, who run this wonderful organisation called Maramaring that provides healing and training for the traumatised. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.